Oh boy. Oh boy. Money, money, money. Do I need to get my $46 out of the bank? I can't afford to lose it. Bank failures. Why is this happening to me? Who's to blame? How's it gonna get fixed? I'll talk about the recent banking failures. I'll also discuss a little bit about the possible Trump indictments. Just a little. Just a little. And I'm going to talk about Elizabeth Warren. Oh, Elizabeth Warren. How can someone so smart sound so silly sometimes? Come on, let's discuss. Welcome to the Comparison Group podcast. Today is March 22nd, 2023. No indictment news or arrest news yet, as far as I know. Let me just say something, a couple things about that very quickly to start. Get it out of the way. I don't have much to say right now because I don't have a whole lot to add to the conversation. Nothing to add that I'm sure you can't get anywhere else. But what I'll say is Donald Trump is innocent until proven guilty, as I saw Steve Schmidt tweet out. He's innocent until proven guilty, kind of in the same way Derek Chauvin, the man convicted of murdering George Floyd, was innocent until proven guilty. In other words, we all watched Donald Trump's misdeeds, quote unquote, potential crimes, play out on national TV. We all saw it. You can still go look at it, find it on YouTube, or go listen to some of the things he said or did. So he's innocent until proven guilty, but okay. And this is political, as Republicans are saying. This investigation, this possible indictment, this particular possible indictment of Donald Trump for paying hush money to a porn star, it is political in the sense that if this was Joe Blow the Butcher who had done this, no one would care. But it's also political in the sense that if Joe Blow the Butcher had done something like this, they would have been indicted, had a trial, and either been acquitted or found guilty of it years ago. If this was some state legislator, this would have been done years ago if they didn't have the political influence and the money that Donald Trump has. So, yes, there's no question. It's all political. That doesn't change what he did. Donald Trump did what he did. And based on the main witness, Michael Cohen, his former attorney, it would appear that he did something, because I don't think Michael Cohen was in the habit of just going around paying hush money to random porn stars. I would imagine he knew to go pay hush money to Stormy Daniels because Donald Trump said, "I raw dogged her. You got to go pay her some hush money." I don't think Michael Cohen just took it upon himself to do that. So it seems fairly obvious something got done here. Let the investigation play out, which I guess it has at this point. And if the indictment comes, then have a trial. And if he's found guilty, he's found guilty. If he's found innocent, he's found innocent of how he went about paying the porn star. How he went about paying Stormy Daniels. I'll stop calling her a porn star. Poor girl. The only other thing I'll say right now is I don't know if people are asking the question, why are Republicans defending Donald Trump rhetorically? I mean, I see people all over the news. I can't believe these Republicans are defending Donald Trump. Do you really not know? Are you seriously asking that question? They're defending Donald Trump because it's better for them. Has nothing to do with Donald Trump. It's better for them politically for a certain segment of the Republican base to never cave into pressure, to never admit that you were wrong. You've been defending Donald Trump if you were certain Republicans. So to stop now is worse. To cave in and stop defending him, you will be hurt worse politically than if you just say, oh yeah, well, on this one, he's guilty. No, a certain segment of the Republican base does not want anyone to ever cave in, ever admit guilt, ever admit anything was done wrong. It's all just Democrats going after Donald Trump. So you got to stick with that. You married that. You got to stick with that. It's as simple as that. I don't know if people on the left, some of the people on the left think Kevin McCarthy is talking to them when he makes excuses for Donald Trump or defends Donald Trump. He's not. He's talking to a certain segment of the Republican base. Stop thinking he's talking to you and acting all shocked and surprised when he defends Donald Trump. He doesn't care what you think. If you're a Biden voter, if you're a true blue Democrat, he's not trying to win you over. So stop asking the question, oh, how can these Republicans defend Donald Trump? Because they're not talking to you. They're talking to their base. And a ridiculous defense is way better than caving into pressure in their eyes, in some segment of the Republican base's eyes. Simple as that. Moving on to the recent bank failures. Now, first, let me assure you, I am woefully out of my depths in a full understanding of exactly what's going on. I think it's nice to say that because you have so many people now who think they got it all figured out from day one. It's all Biden's fault. It's all Trump's fault. I don't know. I think it's too early to make a conclusive determination of what exactly went wrong. So I'll start by saying that. I'm going to discuss a little bit, but understand, I got to warn you, I have no interest in discussing this politically. No interest in trying to place blame politically right now. I believe in common sense, facts as best as we can know them right now, and above all, consistency. So based on that, why do banks fail? Why did we have these recent bank failures at Silicon Valley Bank and Signature? Because banks fail. Banks fail all the time. A bank is a business. Businesses fail all the time. We may not see the bank failures because before the banks quote unquote collapse or completely fail, a bigger bank swoops in and acquires the failing bank. As in the case of Credit Suisse in Switzerland, Switzerland's second largest bank, that with the help of the Swiss government was acquired by UBS, Switzerland's largest bank. So that bank was on its way to failure, and another bank steps in and acquires it, saves it. So we don't always see these failures, but they happen all the time. A bank is just a business. So banks fail for the same reason businesses fail: mismanagement, bad risk-taking, being undercapitalized, competition, bad luck, all sorts of reasons. So is it Trump's fault? Is it Trump's fault for deregulating a portion of the Dodd-Frank bill passed back in 2018? That's what you hear a lot of people saying. Bernie Sanders is saying, Elizabeth Warren is saying. This is all directly related to Donald Trump and what he did back in 2018, deregulating small to mid-sized banks. Is that the case? The short answer, it sure as heck didn't help. Sure as heck didn't help. The longer, probably more accurate answer is it would be very difficult right now to draw a straight line from what Trump did to the Dodd-Frank bill in 2018 and the crisis at Credit Suisse that resulted in it being acquired by UBS. Credit Suisse, been around for 166 years. Like I said, the second largest bank in Switzerland. This banking crisis, if you want to call it a crisis, that we're going through right now is worldwide. So much like back when people were saying Biden was to blame for the high inflation and people responded, oh, no, you can't blame Biden or his policies or what he did because it's worldwide. Well, you kind of have to take just a step back and say, well, the banking crisis right now is a worldwide problem. So you may not be able to directly link it to something, a policy from Donald Trump. And if you say, well, what happens here in America affects the rest of the world, be careful, because that's the same thing I said about inflation. When people were defending Biden by saying inflation's worldwide, I said, well, what happens here in America affects the rest of the world. So it's a little too soon to know for certain that what Trump did directly caused the collapse of these two banks. But like I said, it sure didn't help. But again, consistency above all else. You have six world central banks right now, world central banks that are lending emergency funds to one another right now to shore up their financial markets, shore up the banking industry. Now, is it all Biden's fault? Looking at it from the other side, is it all Biden's fault because of his policies that have caused high inflation, which in turn has caused interest rates to rise rapidly, which was one of the main factors in the Silicon Valley Bank collapse. Is it his fault? I would look at it this way. Parents buy their son their first car. It's a beat-up 10-year-old Ford Mustang. The father says, we're going to fix this baby up, supercharge the engine, put racing tires on it. He turns it into a hot rod and puts full insurance on it. The mother, wanting to save some money, deregulates the insurance. You get it? She changes it to just basic coverage. Well, the son totals the car. The mother blames the father for souping up the car. The father blames the mother for changing the insurance, saying if you had kept the insurance in place, we would have been covered. Well, the totaling of the car was still going to happen. It was still going to happen no matter what, because you gave an irresponsible person something you shouldn't have given them. If we allow banks to take more risk, banks are going to take more risk. If we allow banks to soup up their earnings to the max, they will soup up their earnings to the max. So the mother can't turn around and say to the father, well, I didn't expect him to drive like a maniac. What did you expect him to do? What did you think was going to happen? That's kind of the case with the banks. What do you expect them to do? They will push to the limits that you set for them. So everyone has to be a little bit responsible, because it doesn't become a problem for everyone until the accident happens. Prior to that, when the earnings are flowing in, hey, nobody cares. When investors are making a ton of money, no one really cares. It's only when the accident happens that the fingers of blame start to get pointed. What Trump did in regards to his deregulation was a bipartisan thing. Democrats were on board with it. I think there were 31 in the House that voted alongside the Republicans and 16 in the Senate that voted along with the Republicans in the deregulation of Dodd-Frank. So it wasn't just Trump. It wasn't just Republicans. Democrats were on board with it, too. So the fingers of blame can kind of get pointed, you know, in all different directions after the accident happens. That's my common sense take of it. Now, my, you know, lack of knowledge, common sense take. What do the people who are more knowledgeable, the experts, say? Aaron Klein, a senior fellow in economic studies at the Brookings Institute, believes the Federal Reserve, missed several classic red flags in basic banking supervision. First, explosive asset growth. Signature Valley Bank nearly quadrupled its assets in 4 years. Quadrupled. Second, Signature Valley Bank relied heavily on uninsured deposits. In other words, deposits over that $250,000 that's insured by the FDIC, they were relying heavily on deposits above that. So in other words, if you have $500,000 in a bank and you know $250,000 of that is uninsured, well, you're far more likely to go pull your money out of that bank at the first sign of trouble because you know it's not insured. Third, Signature Valley Bank bought over $100 billion of mortgage-backed securities at low interest rates. Those doggone mortgage-backed securities again. The problem was they didn't do anything to hedge against the potential of those investments losing value if interest rates rose, which of course they did. And so, bad luck, bad bet. They made a bad bet there. So those were things that Aaron Klein feels like the Fed should have been on top of and should have spotted and should have stepped in to do something way before things got as bad as they did. Now, you have other economists that'll tell you the failure of Signature Valley Bank was not obvious. If it was, you would have had a ton of people shorting, in other words, banking on the bank to fail because they would have made money. They would have shorted their investment on that bank, but they didn't. So it wasn't obvious that it was, you know, about to fail. And based on how it looked financially in the months leading up to the collapse and its third quarter report, there wasn't too much cause for alarm. According to Kent Smetters, a professor of business and economic policy at UPenn, at UPenn's Wharton School, an enhanced stress test, the kind that kind of got taken out by that Trump deregulation, an enhanced stress test probably would not have found anything all that unusual. So in the end, it was probably just a sharp increase in interest rates that doomed the bank, and there was nothing that could have been done about it. Correction, Silicon Valley Bank. I just realized I kept saying Signature Valley Bank. It was Silicon Valley Bank and Signature. So correction there. Sorry. Bottom line, is it going to affect you and me? Is it going to affect us? Is it over? Is it going to get worse? Well, I guess it all depends. Oh, it depends. Banks have to do a better job of managing risk. Banking regulators have to do a better job. And the Fed has to do a better job of stepping in when they need to, and a better job of giving a clear, no BS answer as to where the interest rates are going in this country. No more of this, we're aiming for a soft landing. We're aiming for a soft landing. The uncertainty is just killing us. And I know it's an impossible balancing act. I know that. You know, again, what I know about this stuff is not a lot. So I know the Fed has an impossible balancing act to perform to try and moderate the inflation at the same time they're dealing with the interest rates, at the same time they're trying to make sure people don't lose their jobs. I know it's hard. But if you go back, I hate to do this, I'm not going to play clips because you'll get sick of me always playing clips from past shows where I said, but 6 months ago, I did a show entitled, When Will Inflation End? And in that show, I discussed John Taylor, who wrote The Taylor Rule. And I read an interview that John Taylor had did. Now, John Taylor wrote The Taylor Rule for the Fed, just to clarify real quickly. But it's not just followed by our Fed. It's followed by central banks all over the world. And it's been in place for 30 years. And there are other rules, not just his rule. There are other rules. I think there are five rules that the Fed is supposed to follow when it comes to setting interest rates. I'm just seeing here there's another article from November of 2022 that Taylor did with NPR. At the time, the Fed had raised interest rates to just under 4%. And Taylor talks about this should have been done a year ago. And so in that show, I read the interview and I discussed that John Taylor was saying, based on if the Fed was following the rules that they're supposed to, that guide them in setting interest rates, the interest rates would be much higher. This would probably lead to layoffs, to unemployment. And Taylor, use a big word here, postulated that if they do this, this small change, maybe a 1% change in unemployment, would bring the interest rates, would bring the inflation down quickly, because it had risen so quickly, it would come down just as quickly if they simply followed the rules. But they weren't. For some reason, the Fed was not following the rules. I encourage you to go listen to that show, because it would appear it has a lot to do with what just transpired between Elizabeth Warren and Fed Chairman Jerome Powell. I'm going to play a clip for you from a Senate hearing in which Elizabeth Warren grilled Fed Chairman Jerome Powell, and then we'll discuss. All right, here's the clip.
So the Fed has raised interest rates 8 times over the last year in what has been the most extreme rate hike cycle in 40 years. The Fed's goal is to slow inflation, and your tool, raising interest rates, is designed to slow the economy and throw people out of work. So far, you haven't tipped the economy into recession, but you haven't brought inflation entirely under control either. And maybe the reason for that is that other things are also keeping prices high, things you can't fix with high interest rates, things like price gouging and supply chain kinks and a war in Ukraine. But you are determined to continue to raise interest rates, so I want to take a look at where you're headed. In December, the Fed released its projections on the state of the economy under your monetary policy plan. According to the Fed's own report, if you continue raising interest rates as you plan, unemployment will be 4.6% by the end of the year, more than a full point higher than it is today. Chair Powell, if you hit your projections, do you know how many people who are currently working, going about their lives, will lose their jobs?
I don't have that number in front of me. I will say it's not an intended consequence.
But it is, and it's in your report, and that would be about 2 million people who would lose their jobs, people who are working right now, making their mortgages. So, Chair Powell, if you could speak directly to the 2 million hardworking people who have decent jobs today, who you're planning to get fired over the next year, what would you say to them? How would you explain your view that they need to lose their jobs?
I would explain to people more broadly that inflation is extremely high and it's hurting the working people of this country badly. All of them, not just 2 million of them, but all of them are suffering under high inflation. And we are taking the only measures we have to bring inflation down.
And putting 2 million people out of work is just part of the cost, and they just have to bear it?
Will working people be better off if we just walk away from our jobs and inflation remains 5-6%?
Let me ask you about what happens if you do this. Since the end of World War II, there have been 12 times in which the unemployment rate has increased by one percentage point within 1 year, exactly what you're aiming to do right now. How many of those times did the U.S. economy avoid falling into a recession?
You know, it's not as black and white as it very,
just
very
infrequent. Just looking at the numbers, it actually is pretty black.
Alan Blinder's written a book on this. And
there have been 12 times that we've seen a 1 point increase in the unemployment rate in a year. That's exactly what your Fed report has put out as the projection and the plan based on how you're going to keep raising these interest rates. How many times did the economy fail to fall into a recession after doing that out of 12 times?
I think the number is zero.
I think the number is zero. That's exactly right. You know, Chair Powell, you are gambling with people's lives, and there's a pile of data showing that price gouging and supply chain kinks and the war in Ukraine are driving up prices. You cling to the idea that there's only one solution: lay off millions of workers. We need a Fed that will fight for families. And if you're not going to lead that charge, we need someone at the Fed who will.
So let me say this. I don't talk about Elizabeth Warren, or I haven't talked about Elizabeth Warren as much as I have talked about Bernie Sanders or Alexandria. I went to Antarctica for spring break, Ocasio-Cortez, but she really drives me crazy sometimes. Elizabeth Warren does. Steve Schmidt, who I mentioned earlier, the former campaign manager for John McCain, a conservative you can respect, a really smart guy, tweeted out recently, Elizabeth Warren gets it. Elizabeth Warren gets it. And I'm sure a lot of people on the left would listen to that clip and say, yeah, she does. She gets it. I replied back to Steve Schmidt, she gets the problem, but not the solution. She always gets the problem, but does not get the solution. Or at least doesn't appear to have good solutions, in my opinion, my humble opinion. And so that's not getting it to me. If you just get the problem, but you don't have any solutions, that's not getting it to me. And before you say, oh, what a smart guy, what about your solutions? Well, stay tuned, number one. And number two, go back and listen to the last 5 or 6 episodes. They're chock full of solutions. Whether you agree with them or not is a different story, but they're chock full of solutions, suggestions, ideas. And I have no axe to grind with Elizabeth Warren. I respect her intelligence. I respect her diligence at her job. I respect her sincerity to help people. I respect all that. Same as I've said with Bernie Sanders and Alexandria. I took my cousin to the prom, Ocasio-Cortez. I respect them. But Elizabeth Warren will often tell you she's a capitalist. That's what she'll say. Whenever you criticize her, hey, she'll say, listen, I'm a capitalist. Well, that's like Kim Kardashian saying, hey, I'm attracted to white guys. Well, your behavior would seem to indicate otherwise. Elizabeth Warren's behavior would seem to indicate otherwise. I got to stop using Kim Kardashian as the brunt of my jokes. It's not fair. That's like Khloe Kardashian saying, hey, I'm attracted to white guys. The behavior indicates otherwise. When it comes to Elizabeth Warren and all of her attacks on the rich or on corporations or on the Fed, because there's plenty of clips of her on YouTube that she has put up herself, that she likes to put up on YouTube, of her attacking rich people, corporations, the Fed, constantly, constantly. She's very proud of it. And again, I get it. But don't try and pass yourself off as a capitalist if you're always seeing things from a one-sided point of view. She's hammering Jerome Powell based on the Fed's plan to raise interest rates in a way that they are projecting may put people out of work. And she says, this has happened 12 times where unemployment has risen by a point, and all 12 times we've gone into a recession. That's the point that she's making, that she's hammering him on. If you do this, you're going to push us into a recession. And she says it's happened 12 times, so therefore, bad idea, right? Well, context. The recession of 1949, it began in 1948, lasted until October of 1949, began shortly after Truman's Fair Deal economic reforms. Many say it was because of the aftermath of World War II. Recession of 1953. Policies by the Fed sent interest rates plummeting, which led to a demand-driven and employment recession because of government spending and investment. 1958, Eisenhower recession. Bunch of factors. 1960 to 61, recession because of Fed tightening monetary policy. Unemployment reached a peak of 7.1% in 1961. 1969 to 1970 came at the end of the third longest period of economic growth we have ever had. At the end of this expansion, inflation was rising as a result of deficit spending during a period of full employment. 73 to 75, a period of stagflation. High unemployment and high interest rates existed simultaneously. 1980 recession, brought on by increasing the federal funds rate, making credit harder to obtain for cars and home loans. The early 1990s recession, the early 2000s recession, unemployment hit a peak of 7.8% in mid-1992. The Great Recession of 2007 to 2009, caused by the housing bubble, and the COVID recession from February to April of 2020. Those are Elizabeth Warren's 12 examples of when increasing unemployment was followed by a recession. I said 11, but I'm counting 1980 as one because it was two recessions in that same year. They counted as two. I'm counting it as one. So those are the 12 examples. So what's the point? There is no point. There is no point. That's my point. I've never heard someone so proud to make a point that has no point. What is the point? What is Elizabeth Warren saying? Is she saying she never wants us to go into a recession? Is she saying, well, if we have to go into a recession, find another way to put us into a recession? I don't know what she's saying. Is she saying, solve this problem, but don't solve it the only way we know how to solve it? Figure out another way. Invent another way. Fine, Elizabeth Warren, you give us the way. You give us the way to solve the inflation problem without raising interest rates and without people losing their jobs. You tell us how to do it. There is no point. I can't believe I even looked that stuff up and read it to you because there's no point. There's absolutely no point. Hey, this happened 12 times, so this happened 12 times. Here's my point to Elizabeth Warren. You cannot throw a party and then complain about the cleanup. You can't do it. We are currently, or have been, in the longest period of growth in this country's history. Take out that little short recession during COVID, and starting back in around 2008, 2009, once we got kind of past the housing bubble collapse, we have been steadily growing up to this point. The longest period of growth in our history. That's because the Fed and Congress has been throwing a party. The Fed has been printing trillions of dollars, partly because of COVID, but even before COVID, starting with the recovery from the Great Recession. The Fed has been printing money. We have been deficit spending. So we've had the party now for years, and it's time for the cleanup. You can't complain about that. At some point, you gotta pay the piper. Inflation comes about because of too much money in the economy. You cannot put trillions of dollars in the economy and not expect there to be inflation. And the only way to counter it is to take some of that money out of the economy. And the only way to do that is to raise interest rates, make money more expensive. And yes, that will lead to people losing their jobs. Just as John Taylor said 6 months ago, and I talked about in my show 6 months ago, a slight adjustment in unemployment will quickly reduce this inflation. Just as quickly as it rose, we can bring it down if we take the steps we need to bring it down. So you're telling me what I talked about, little old me, know nothing guy, 6 months ago on this podcast, is what Jerome Powell is trying to explain to Senator Warren in a Senate hearing? Yep, that's exactly what I'm telling you. And she ain't getting it. because she only sees it one way. Only sees it one way. It's the corporations, it's the greed, it's the supply chains, it's Ukraine. Go back and listen to the episode. When will inflation end? The man who wrote the rules that central banks use all over the world said, oh yeah, those are factors. Ukraine, supply chains, those are all factors. But what is driving inflation is these low interest rates. The interest rates have to be higher. People have got to stop spending. A business has no incentive to charge you less if you are willing to pay them more. No incentive. Why? Because they're greedy. They're greedy. Elizabeth Warren, you've sold me on the problem. I'm buying it. Corporations are greedy. So the answer is not to give people more money so that they can spend more money so corporations make more record profits. That's not the answer for greedy corporations. They're like, thank you very much. Keep giving it. Keep giving it. And we'll keep raising our prices. And Jerome Powell, who I'm not defending, who I think, you know, listen, again, with my limited knowledge, I think, you know, hasn't been great, made some bad decisions. But Jerome Powell gave her the answer. She's, oh, you're just going to put 2 million people out of work, 3 million people, 4 million people out of work. What do you tell those people? And Jerome Powell gave her the answer. I tell him, look, everybody is suffering, not just 2 million people. Everyone is suffering with this high inflation. You're through the party. Now it's time for the cleanup. Those people losing their jobs is the cleanup. You say, well, sure, comparison group guy. What if you're one of those people losing your job? I'm already hurting because of the high inflation. I hope I don't lose my job. I hope no one I know loses their job. But we're already all suffering because of the high inflation. It has to be brought under control. If she has a better solution to bring it under control, by all means, offer it. If you have a better solution, by all means, offer it. Everyone threw the party. And some people want to keep the party going. The Fed threw the party by keeping interest rates far too low for far too long. The banks threw the party by raking in quadruple profits on risky investments. The investors threw the party by taking the big returns on those investments. Wall Street threw the party. And look around you, Senator Warren. Some of the people who cashed in on the party are sitting right there with you in Congress. And Congress threw the party by passing bills with too much stimulus. Too much. Stimulus checks, unemployment checks, enhanced unemployment checks, ability to skip mortgage payments, ability to skip car payments, rent payments without the risk of eviction, increased food stamps, a pause on paying student loans, all while the Fed was purchasing billions in bonds every month and keeping interest rates at zero. You can't do that. You just can't do that and not expect a cleanup. Senator Warren, can you tell me how many times in the history of the world has any country been able to pump trillions of dollars into their economy and it not come back to bite them in the butt?
I think the number is zero.
I think the number is zero. That's exactly right. You can't do it. You can't pump trillions of dollars in the economy. No country can do it. $9 trillion spent in 2022, $10 trillion spent in 2021, $10 trillion spent the year before that. It should be indicative to you that Biden's budget for this year is over $6 trillion, almost $7 trillion, that much less. So it shows you just how much more we've been spending in recent years. Again, related to COVID, but too much has to be a correction now. Sorry, but there has to be a correction now. And yelling at Jerome Powell doesn't change that. Acting like Jerome Powell wants to push 2 million people at the top of the Sears Tower is not going to change that. If we have leaders who will look the American people in the eye and say, look, you ain't going to like this, but we got to make some changes. For the long term and for the good of everyone, we got to make some changes. If we had leaders who will do that, as opposed to every time there's a little price increase somewhere, start talking about maybe we need to do another round of stimulus checks. Or as Joe Biden suggested and others suggested, maybe we need to send people gas cards when gas prices spiked. I remember I was listening to CNBC and they had a couple of guys on there and they weren't political guys. They were investment guys and they were befuddled They were befuddled. Who's advising Biden is what they asked. If gas prices are high, you don't send people gas cards so they can pay the high prices, because the oil companies will only keep the prices high. You hope that people tighten their belts, drive less, bring down the demand, which will then bring down the prices. I swear, I don't know if this sounds unreasonable to people. If it sounds callous to say, hey, look, people got to lose their jobs. Things got to get worse. Our leaders have to explain that to people. I don't know if it sounds callous, but to me, what is callous is pretending like you and I aren't spending 35% more for groceries, or 45% more for rent, or 25% more for utilities, or 10% more for childcare, or 20% more for credit. To me, that's callous, to pretend that that's not happening and that the answer to it is just to tax the rich. To me, that's callous. When I was preparing for this show, I did a little checking into Senator Warren. And what I found out just might shock you. When it comes to Elizabeth Warren and taxes, paying her taxes, she pays her taxes. She pays what you would expect someone who talks like her to pay. She pays that top rate. You know, she earns a good living. You know, I'll amend my earlier statement. When it comes to making money, she is a capitalist, because when she started out in Congress in 2008, I believe it was, she was making around $500,000 a year. And now she's up to about $1.2 million a year. So, yeah, she's a capitalist when it comes to earning money, but she pays her taxes. She pays about a third. You know, she's just under, you know, about 33%. You know, maybe just a couple points under the top tax, but who's going to quibble with 2%? When it comes to her honesty, I checked her PolitiFact. She's honest. She doesn't lie. A couple of misstatements here and there, but for the most part, she's honest. I look into her, what she says, how she talks, what she does. She's sincere. She means what she says. So how can someone who puts their money where their mouth is sincere, how can they be part of the problem and not the solution? Well, because she only sees things one way. That's why. She's not helping us with solutions, because she only sees the problem one way, with one solution. Are you going to tell me you don't think the high prices for fast food, for McDonald's, or for Burger King is not related to the higher cost of labor? Are you going to seriously tell me that is not playing any factor whatsoever in inflation, the higher cost for labor? If someone is starting pay at McDonald's now is $18 an hour, and 5 or 6 years ago it was $12 an hour, you don't think that's factoring in? And so you may say, well, that's great. People making more money. That's what needs to happen. But there's a counterbalance to that. Now, when you go to McDonald's, everything is more expensive. And so for people who are on a fixed budget, like maybe retired people or maybe younger people who don't make a lot of money, they're getting hurt by that. People are getting hurt by that. The very people you want to help end up getting hurt by those higher costs. So when the government intervenes too much in pushing up that cost of labor, as they did during COVID, when that higher cost in labor is not driven by a real demand for labor, but because the government intervened with too much money in the economy, now you have a problem. Demand for the products and services did not create the labor shortage. The government did. That's a problem. When the government creates the labor shortage, when businesses are offering $1,000 bonuses and way higher pay than the market should demand for a particular job, when the government causes that, that's a problem. Elizabeth Warren doesn't see it that way. She's never seen it that way. Neither does Bernie Sanders, and neither does Alexandria, voted most likely to hate the comparison group guy, Ocasio-Cortez. They see it their way and only their way. And that's why they're great at identifying the problems and the unfairness and the inequality in incomes, but they're short on coming up with actual legitimate solutions that work. It's all about the millionaires and the billionaires. It's all about the corporations. It's all about the greed and nothing else. And it's all about the government stepping in and spending money to fix it. It's all about taxing and then spending the money to fix it, to level the playing field. And that can't be the only solution. Elizabeth Warren, Can you tell me how much money a billionaire should be able to keep?
I think the number is zero.
Oh, I know you do. That's the show. Thanks for listening. I certainly do appreciate you investing your time. As always, you know I do. I like it. I like it when you invest your time. Don't forget to share the show. Apple Podcasts, Spotify. Copy the link. Paste it. Paste it, paste it, paste it. Paste it everywhere. Paste it on your Facebook. Paste it on your Twitter. Where else? Instagram. Well, I don't think you can do it on Instagram. Please share it. Please give the show a rating. Ooh, I have exciting news. Can't forget. Be quiet. I have exciting news. You can now go on Spotify and leave comments on Spotify. They have the ability for me to create a poll, which I will do occasionally, but you can also leave comments about the show, and other people can see your comments. I think... Got to hit the vocals there. I think it might be specifically to the mobile app of Spotify. I don't know. I don't understand Spotify sometimes. I have trouble because things don't work for me. Ratings, giving ratings on Spotify. But if you check it out, if you listen on Spotify or you want to go listen on Spotify, you can leave a comment. You get 200 characters where we can have a discussion back and forth. You can tell me what you think about what I said, and other people will be able to see your comments. And so you can get into discussion with other people that listen to the show. Very excited about this. This is what I want to do. This is what the comparison group is supposed to be. The ability for us to have a discussion, a civil discussion. Don't put nothing stupid, because I have the ability to moderate it. And if you just put stupid stuff up there, if you just put links up there, I'm not gonna share that. So give me some good, interesting feedback, and other people will be able to see it. So make sure you check that out on Spotify. Got to remember to wish all the women out there, a happy Women's History Month. It's coming to an end. I'm remiss. I haven't done it yet, so let me make sure I do it now. Thank you to all the women out there. Oh, listen to this guy talking over me. Thank you to all the women for what you've done, what you do, what you continue to do every single day. And a very happy Women's History Month to everyone.
Where you twat up and down around the corner. I can smell you a mile away. Your perfume has a rare scent.
That's the show. Thanks again for listening. Please remember to share it. Please remember to rate it. And please remember to follow or subscribe so that the show will come to you for free. For free. You don't have to go looking for it. You don't have to wonder when I'm going to post a new show. Will come to you for free on any of the podcast listening apps. I prefer Apple or Spotify. Trying to move up the charts over there. But Google Podcasts, Amazon Music, Pandora, iHeartRadio, Podbreed Network, Podcast. Oh, the show's everywhere. It's everywhere. Go get it. Thanks. I'll see you next time.
Like when I'm all alone with you, you know exactly.